Hello, and welcome to episode number 22 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. When UFO enthusiasts think back to the origins of the modern UFO phenomenon, the decade of the 1940s certainly stands out. Of course, this was the decade that saw the Roswell event reportedly happen, when a craft, apparently piloted by beings who were decidedly non-human, crashed into the desert of New Mexico. Rumors of crash retrievals, attempts at reverse-engineered technologies, and the recovery of alien bodies, of course, swirl around the historical account of this famous event, an event now seared into the collective memory of our entire culture. The 1940s also birthed the first mention of the term flying saucer, when private pilot Kenneth Arnold reportedly saw shiny, unidentified flying objects flying past Mount Rainier at remarkable velocity. This sighting created an uproar in the media and in American popular culture, and Arnold's description of these UFOs subsequently led the press to coin the terms flying saucer and flying disc as popular descriptors. According to a new book by ufology legend Jacques Vallée and his co-author Paula Harris, the popular historical record as it pertains to the UFO phenomenon is missing a major milestone from that remarkable decade. Here they refer to an event that predates both of the aforementioned famous occurrences. In 1945, 2 years previous to Roswell, there was another crash in the desert of New Mexico. And this event had witnesses still alive today, witnesses that were interviewed at length by both Vallée and Harris. And in addition to extensive interviews with the living witnesses of that remarkable event, Vallée and Harris spent much time in the very location of the reported crash, examining the land and circumstances that surround the event in painstaking scientific detail. Of course, that particular location is famous for more than the crash of a sophisticated craft piloted by non-human beings. It is also the very same location of the detonation of the very first atomic bomb. And as if that coincidence doesn't already grab your attention, the two events happened within weeks of each other. These historical details to Vallée and Harris are too striking to be explained away as mere coincidence. No, in fact, the authors postulate that there is a profound meaning needing to be dusted off and considered here, along with the artifacts of the event itself. And Jacques Vallée and Paula Harris go further, openly questioning the idea that this was an accident at all. To them, it has all the hallmarks of a staged event, one that was meant to send a clear message to humankind at the very dawn of the atomic age. A dark era that erupted onto the canvas of human history with the light of a thousand suns, as the now infamous description goes. Was this a warning, an attempt at the opening of a dialogue, or something else? Many profound questions arise as one learns about the details of this remarkable event, an event that involved not just an apparently alien vehicle piloted by potentially off-world visitors, but telepathic communication between these others and the witnesses that Vallée and Harris interviewed. Even communication offering glimpses into the future of our civilization, including some events that have already come to pass in the time since. The stellar, dedicated investigatory work done by Vallée and Harris is cataloged in their excellent, thorough, and highly readable new book, Trinity, The Best Kept Secret. This book offers, they suggest, evidence that rewrites the modern history of ufology. And it shines light on an event that raises profound questions as to the intentions of these others who have been interacting with us in equally profound yet mysterious ways ever since. A discussion around these thought-provoking questions that stem from that remarkably and uncannily timed event in 1945 are the topic of this, the 22nd episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's episode, I'd just like to share how excited I was when I learned there was a new book coming out by Jacques Vallée. Of course, Jacques Vallée is the gold standard from many people's point of view, including mine, when it comes to research into the UFO phenomenon. Not only has he been at it longer than almost anyone, since the 1960s indeed, but he's been the champion of new ways of thinking, of new paradigms, new hypotheses that have been cutting edge in this field. Of course, I was partly excited by the material of this book. I knew it was going to include crash retrieval discussion and perhaps the study of exotic materials, even at the microscopic level. But overall, whenever Jacques Vallée has a new book coming out pertaining to the UFO phenomenon, it's worth paying attention to. Now, Jacques Vallée's co-author, Paula Harris, became involved in this case even before Vallée. She had been investigating this case for years, in fact, and had already conducted excellent interviews with the witnesses. So that raises the question, how did Jacques Vallée get involved in this Trinity case? How did that begin? Quoting from their book, Trinity, quote, "If my friend Ron Brinkley hadn't insisted on buying me a drink at the legendary Owl Bar and Cafe in San Antonio, New Mexico, I would never have become absorbed in the complex drama of Trinity and in the forgotten records about the first UFO crash in modern history." "You need to see this place," Ron said, as we were sliding into a booth, past dozens of old pictures on the walls, memorabilia from World War II, bits of letters and many dollar bills stapled to the plaster, fluttering in the air every time someone swung the door open. "This is where it all started," he went on. 1945. Forget everything you've heard about the Roswell crash. It's a very significant story, obviously, but it came 2 years later. There are many conflicting tales about it, but no tangible evidence remains, and nobody was there to watch it fall. As for the Kenneth Arnold sighting, which led to the term flying saucer, that was also in June 1947. That's important, but only in terms of what the public was told or not told. "Yes, but the journals loved it," I said. "People could relate to it. The journalists loved it, yes, and the TV people loved it even more," Ron replied. "But in the process, everybody had missed the most significant case. It had quietly taken place here, precisely 1 month after the first nuclear explosion in history, as if in direct response to it. Nobody spoke about it for many years. It happened just a few miles from this diner. That's where we've got to start," unquote. One of the aspects of this book that makes it so compelling and so readable is not just the detailed analysis of the crash itself and the interaction with the occupants as well, but also the discussion of the entire environment, of the culture surrounding the Trinity site, the families that lived in that sparsely populated area, etc. And now I'd like to quote from a section of the book where we set that initial stage. Quote, "Living so close to ground zero, the families of Jose and Remy would soon experience a sudden change in their world, and the two boys would be the first witnesses to the extraordinary event that marks the true beginning of the UFO era in the United States, still unexplained today in spite of its obvious repercussions in the current debates. To the Army, the event would just be one more local mission to investigate the destruction of a radio tower and to recover a strange craft fallen from the sky during a thunderstorm. The young soldiers in the unit barely realized where they were, the history of the place, or the long traditions of the people who actually lived there. Nor did they care. They came in with a jeep and a big truck, did what they were told to do, and went back to White Sands a few days later. To us, however, analyzing the events in the light of 75 years of accumulated data, what the two boys experienced at that special location needs to be brought to light and analyzed in the full context of American technology and culture at the critical time of the end of the Second World War," unquote. As I already mentioned, what partly makes this book so compelling is the description of the characters involved. Specifically, the two boys who were the chief witnesses to the crash and who actually interacted with and saw the occupants of the craft after it crashed. Now, these two boys lived a very interesting life, a life very different than the lives lived by kids today. They would typically spend most of their day roaming the land, roaming their family's ranch, which consisted of tens of thousands of acres. and they would basically be out there keeping track of cattle. And on this particular day, their father had sent them out asking them to keep track of a specific cow that was about to have a calf. And on this day, there was a thunderstorm, and they heard a loud bang, and then something went down. And in the distance, in this hilly area, they saw smoke rising. They knew something had crashed. They thought perhaps it was a plane. And even though these boys were quite young, they went to investigate. So these two boys on horseback travel some distance to arrive at the crash scene. And they get fairly close. And what they see is a craft they describe as avocado in shape. And it was metallic in material and fairly smooth. And there was an opening, whether that was from the accident or something else is unclear, but there was an opening and they could see creatures inside that looked decidedly non-human. And so now we pick up in a portion of the book where they describe what the creatures looked like. Quote, "What happened to the creatures the two boys had seen after the crash? What did they look like? Were they human? And if they were not human, what could we learn about them?" Paola moved the discussion back to the beginning, the very first afternoon during the storm, when the object plowed into the hillside and came to rest with a big open gash, and several creatures in obvious distress inside the damaged craft. Paola asks, "Did you ever, both, when you were discussing as kids, did you ever discuss the beings?" Remy says, "Yes, their heads were comparable to a campamoca." "That's what we saw." Paola says, "What do you mean? You saw them and they look like a bug?" Remy says, "Yes, they were ugly to us at first. Their heads look like a campamoca." Paola says, "Would you say it in English?" Remy says, "The closest translation would be like, heck, a bug, a praying mantis," unquote. Now, when I read this account regarding the appearance of these others, I was taken aback. Not because it's new, because of course we find these praying mantis type figures referred to time and time again. I don't know how many times we've already discussed them on the various episodes of the Point of Convergence podcast. But here we have the very first event in modern UFO history, 1945, right at the beginning. And we see an event that involves these praying mantis beings. And interestingly, they hint at it here, and it's discussed elsewhere in the book. These beings didn't really walk as if their feet were touching the ground. It's more like they glided back and forth. And the boys describe it as they just willed themselves from one place to another. And as the book described, and as we just touched on, they were in some distress. The scene, at least what the boys were intended to see, was apparently involving creatures who were in distress because they had just crashed a craft. They even let out a high-pitched whine that the boys perceived as a kind of crying, almost like an infant crying. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, this interaction also involved telepathic communication. And of course, this is also very common in the UFO phenomenon literature. And I want to quote again from the book where this is discussed. Quote, "Remy confirms to Paola that the situation was emotional, but something else then comes into his recollection, something more than the realization that they've just watched an airplane crash. He says, "Then we saw these pictures in our heads," he says. Surprised, she asked him to repeat that statement, and he confirms there were pictures, adding, "I don't know what the heck they were. I can remember what they were. I got pictures, but I don't know what they meant then. And I still don't know. They must have known we were there." This statement is important because it marks the first instance of a kind of interaction between the phenomenon and its witnesses that may be fundamental to our eventual understanding of the UFO problem in general. Witnesses are an integral part of the event, unquote. So there was a lot discussed there. So let's break it down a little bit. Let me paint the picture a little clearer. So the boys were looking from some distance, but not too far away, and they could see these creatures moving back and forth. At no point did the creatures actually turn and look at them directly, from what they recall. And yet, pictures suddenly appeared in their head that didn't come from their own imagination or from their memory. Just spontaneously, these images started coming into their heads. And that's what makes Remy conclude they must have known we were there, because these messages were being sent. It was either being sent from these creatures or someone else in the vicinity. But clearly these images, these thoughts that came into their head telepathically were coming from somewhere. And what's truly fascinating, it's only just touched on in the book, but Paula Harris has discussed it in more detail in some other podcasts. One of the images they saw was of human beings falling from tall buildings. And of course, when you read this, you immediately think of 9/11 and people jumping from the two towers. Was this what they saw in 1945? One really wonders, which raises all sorts of interesting questions of where these creatures come from and when they come from. It's also important to note that here Vallée states how important it is that we pay attention to witnesses, how central their testimony is in order for us to reconstruct the events and understand the underlying meaning of the UFO phenomenon. Now, this is key, and Vallée returns to this point time and time again in his writing. He believes the main purpose of these events, these sightings, and these interactions with apparently non-human intelligence is primarily psychical, that it's meant to play a role in shaping our consciousness. And that's why he pays so much attention to it here, and he makes note of this very first case where we have telepathic communication between these others and human beings. Now, these boys were very curious, and they didn't just see the crashed craft one time. No, they went back several times. One time they went back even after the military had shown up and were preparing to haul away the debris. And on an evening when the military personnel had already gone to the Owl for drinks and whatnot, the boys snuck into the site and actually went aboard the craft. And they took some debris back with them, and they buried it in a barn on their property. And then we come to a very interesting, fascinating incident that involves the sheep herder who had an experience with these others in the middle of the night. So let's set the scene here. The boys come back to the property of the ranch and they bury this debris, which they consider treasure or tesoro. That's what they keep calling it. And they bury it underneath a residence on the property where sometimes different workers would live within. And underneath this residence was a gap between the ground floor and the actual ground that was left open in case of flooding. So the boys buried this treasure, quote unquote, underneath this residence. And there was a sheep herder staying in that very residence. And this leads to an experience where the sheep herder is woken up in the middle of the night by strange beings, and he has a telepathic interaction with them. Basically, the way it goes, the sheep herder comes and knocks on the door the next morning, says he needs to speak to the father. And he says, Alejandro, you know, I'm going to have to leave this place. Why? The father asks. Well, he says, you know, last night I was asleep and I got woke up. I saw this light out there by the well. There was this light out there and I, and here Remy hesitates, the book says, because he was emotional. Paula says, okay, he saw a light by the well. Remy says, by the well, and he says, I looked out the window and the next thing, there's these three critters in my room and the door's locked. And so he points towards the floor and they're saying, tesoro. Paula, oh no, you never told me this part of the story. This is incredible. Oh my Lord. Remy says, and so they're pointing there. And so he says, tesoro, there's a treasure down there. And so these guys are doing that, Pedro says. I got my rifle and I'm going to shoot them because they have no business in my house. And so I got my rifle and they're gone. But you know what? They went right through the wall. Can you believe that, Alejandro? Unquote. Now, this is such a fascinating account, such an incredible part of the book. To describe again what happens, the boys bury this treasure, tesoro, underneath this residence. In the middle of the night, this poor sheep herder who's staying in this residence sees a light outside. The next thing he knows, there's three critters. Again, these insect-like beings, these praying mantis-like beings are inside the residence, even though the door is locked. He doesn't know how they got in there. And they keep referring to, telepathically, it's assumed, this tesoro. They're pointing underneath the residence. He doesn't know what they're talking about. Of course, this is referring to what the boys had buried there and even what they called it. So these creatures knew what the boys were thinking and saying on the property. And this sheep herder goes to get his rifle to shoot at these creatures. And they go right through the wall and are gone. A fascinating account. Now you have a sense of the general outline of events. You know about the boys witnessing this initial crash. You know about these boys having telepathic communications with these creatures involving visions of future events, even events that seemingly have come to pass since then. And you know about later occurrences involving communication and appearances involving these creatures inside the barn residence with this sheep herder. Now I'd like to move to a section of the book where Vallée and Harris begin to draw some tentative conclusions and ask some provocative questions. And they don't just discuss this case. They also draw parallels with the Roswell case, as well as the Lonnie Zamora case from Socorro, New Mexico. And they make note that the craft looked quite similar between the Lonnie Zamora case and what was witnessed at Trinity. And this is what the book says, quote, "The few scientists who doggedly followed the reports, interviewed witnesses, and compiled serious files could only look at each other, shake their heads, and ask, if you were smart enough to come here from Alpha Centauri, why would you crash on that guy's farm? I still don't have a good answer to that one. But what if you didn't come from Alpha Centauri at all? What if your spacecraft was designed to crash? What if it was a gift or a signal or a warning? The hopeful inception of a strategic conversation? What if it wasn't a spacecraft, quote unquote, in our current primitive sense of the word? What if you didn't care if the occupants died? Nobody had seriously considered those alternatives," unquote. As I mentioned in the introduction, Vallée and Harris go out of their way to point to the uncanny timing and location of this event that saw the first ever interaction with a UFO and its occupants in the modern era. This happened at the very location and at the very same time period that humankind detonated its first atomic weapon. And this is what Vallée and Harris say to frame this event. Quote, "On August 15th, 1945, the Emperor of Japan, broken, humiliated, and confused, issued an imperial rescript of surrender, accepting the terms of the Potsdam Declaration. And on September 2, 1945, his envoy signed the instrument of surrender on the flight deck of the USS Missouri. And 2 days after the Emperor's surrender, just 1 month after the awesome atomic test by Robert Oppenheimer, Enrico Fermi, and their star team of physicists, a weird object came out of nowhere, circled in the sky over the mesquite-infested hills only some 10 miles north of Trinity, and crashed on a New Mexico ranch, as if to underline the enormity of what had taken place, or to acknowledge it, or to offer a warning perhaps, a sign that somebody else had been watching, or even, in my own speculation, to open a parallel historical and strategic path, one that superseded even the taming of the atomic force? Is that why, a few years later, Canadian government scientist Wilbert Smith of Project Magnet would be quietly briefed on U.S. research on UFOs and told it was classified, quote, higher than the atomic weapon, unquote. Now, one thing that really sets Vallée apart from other UFO researchers is that he doesn't accept simple answers. He asks deeper questions, and most importantly, he pays attention to all the data, even when it seems contradictory, and he assumes when he sees that there must be some deeper meaning, one that is perhaps different than what we see and understand at the surface level. Clearly, the phenomenon defies simple analysis, according to Vallée and Harris. This is something else they postulate about in the book. Quote, "To us, it seems that the phenomenon, and in particular the three detailed cases we have reviewed here, functions with reference to a more complex strategy. It displays just enough to intrigue the witnesses and the society around them, and it uses imagery recognizable to us, but it is sufficiently flexible in time and in space to defeat simple analysis. If that is true, then it's unlikely that we will learn anything really useful or operational about the phenomenon as long as our studies, overt or secret, only concern themselves with the overt technology on the scene as staged for our benefit and framed for our physics." Unquote. Now, on previous episodes of the Point of Convergence podcast, I've talked about various scenarios that await us in our future, scenarios that are potentially dangerous and are even potentially civilization-ending events. One of these I've discussed is the singularity, the technological singularity that is fast approaching. I've described it like a tsunami that is coming at us that most people aren't even aware of. It is going to happen likely within our lifetimes, within the next few decades. It's going to be a convergence of various technologies that will create a very unique point in history that we will either evolve from and come out on the other side, or perhaps collapse under the weight of our own gap between technology and consciousness. And Valet and Harris also touch on this in the book. And I quote, "We believe the phenomenon is not trying to teach us physics or advanced propulsion, although most researchers will keep trying to extract such data or turn it into new weapons. Instead, we believe it is trying to teach us to transcend our own humanity or perish in a toxic mental cloud of our own making when our civilization reaches its point of singularity." Unquote. And now I'd like to offer a final thought for your consideration. What many researchers, politicians, and members of the general public seem to miss in regards to the likely intentions behind the visitation and subtle intervention of a more advanced technological and moral intelligence is that they are likely here not to study us like we do with lesser species at our level of consciousness embedded within the supposedly objective period of materialistic science, but rather in hopes of enabling our evolution, which of course begins with assuring our survival. And if they can see into our own civilization's future, as evidence from this Trinity case and many others suggest, perhaps they are involved in order to help us avoid one particularly dark timeline that may exist in our future, based on our present trajectory. In fact, perhaps they have determined that without such intervention, we are almost certainly headed towards a catastrophic future that they may have already witnessed. And of course, if that's the case, then we would do well to heed their warning with open eyes, ears, minds, and hearts. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, let's keep this conversation going and growing. This past week, we moved past 500 subscribers on YouTube and many more on various podcast networks. That's a great sign. Let's keep this conversation moving forward. Thank you for sharing this with others. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.